just waiting for the end of the world.
Send a happy tune, the more that cracks through you.
In 1986, comic book authors Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons produced the graphic novel Watchmen. Part prophecy, part nihilism, it imagined the end of the world.
The world is lost and blown.
23 years later, with the economy off a cliff and shadowy terrorists roaming the globe, has the Watchmen apocalypse come and gone or still looming? The movie comes out on Friday. Doomsday clock keeps ticking. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, March 3rd, 2009. Farai Chidea is in for Adora Udoji, who's probably not thinking about Watchmen. She's spending time with her new baby. Good morning, Farai.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, we'll look ahead to UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown's visit to the U.S. We're also going to discuss yesterday's tumult on the stock market and find out how interruptions can actually enhance your appreciation for what you're doing. These stories coming up, but first, the headlines.
Interruptions help? More about that later. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is sitting down with top Israeli leaders in Jerusalem today. She says the Obama administration is ready to cooperate with the new Israeli coalition government once it's established.
I want to emphasize the continuing strengths of the United States-Israeli relationship and our unrelenting commitment to Israel's security.
After a meeting today with Israel's foreign minister, Tzipi Livni, Clinton said the U.S. will dispatch two envoys to Syria for preliminary meetings, the most significant sign so far that the Obama administration is considering restoring ties with Damascus. In Washington, U.K. Prime Minister Gordon Brown will meet with President Obama today. The prime minister has been stressing the need for coordinated action to combat the economic crisis. He's asking the U.S. to avoid protectionist measures. Farai?
Well, senior administration officials say that President Obama sent a secret letter to the Russian President Dmitry Medvedev last month. The letter suggests an agreement in which the U.S. would back off from deploying a new missile defense system in Eastern Europe if Russia would help prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. Moscow says the letter didn't offer any such trade-off. Meanwhile, President Obama is sending Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner to the House today to defend the proposed 2010 budget. Lawmakers in both parties have questioned tax increases for high earners. Meanwhile, the Senate is going to hear from Federal Chair Ben Bernanke on the long-term impact of the president's proposals.
On Wall Street yesterday, you may have seen it. The Dow finished below 7,000 for the first time since May 1st, 1997. The S&P slipped under 700 and then finished above. It looks like all of the markets on Wall Street are going to bounce off the bottom. That's according to the futures trading, but then that only affects the first 15 minutes or so. We shall see. The S&P starts trading at 701. Farai and I are thumbing through our Watchmen paperbacks. I used to actually have a hardcover. The movie version of the great graphic novel about flawed superheroes and the end of the world comes out on Friday. Who are your flawed superheroes? And has the Watchmen apocalypse come and gone 23 years after it was published? Or is it still looming? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And if you're just out of all this Watchmen obsession, you can tell us that too.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Farai Chidea is here for Adora Udoji. Thanks for joining us this week.
I am delighted.
And for the next couple of weeks, we've got a lot of things on the program that we want to talk about. Later on, we're going to talk about the brain science of interruptions. Are you an interrupter? What would you do with your uninterrupted time?
Hey, I'm talking here.
There we go. Interruptions actually have a positive influence on the brain. Speaking of positives, there are positives in the movie Watchmen that comes out on Friday. The graphic novel is full of all sorts sorts of apocalyptic predictions about the future. Have they come and gone? What's your take on Watchmen? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We are joined by Philip Stevens, associate editor of the Financial Times. Philip is here to discuss British Prime Minister Gordon Brown as he begins an official visit to the U.S. today. He used to be Chancellor of the Exchequer, so he knows all about the U.K. economy, and I suspect, Philip Stevens, that's going to be on the mind of the U.K. Prime Minister as he sits down with President Barack Obama today, wouldn't you say?
I think it's at the very top of his mind. Now, I mean, these meetings are always a bit more important for British prime ministers than they are for American presidents. I mean, ever since we lost our empire half a century ago, we get a bit neurotic about how seriously we're taken in Washington.
How did you do that, lose the empire? I mean, it is a huge thing, you know, to lose.
Well, it was a big thing. As I remember, one or two American presidents helped us along the way.
Yes,
on that. But this meeting matters a lot for Gordon Brown because he's hosting this this big summit in London at the beginning of April called the G20 Summit, when leaders from all over the world, from China and Russia, as well as from the Western industrial countries, are getting together in London to see if they can fix the global financial system. And this meeting can be a success only if President Obama engages and puts, if you like, America's weight behind it. So far, he hasn't. Gordon Brown will be saying to him today, look, we've got to make this summit a success for America's good as well as the world's.
Now, is it possible, because if you look at the sort of numbers in the UK, the economic situation there conceivably is more dire than it is in the United States, even than other places in Europe. The financial sort of stability in the city seems to have taken a real hit, particularly because it was dependent so much on investments from Asia. Is there any suspicion that Gordon Brown might be whispering in Barack Obama's ear some looming difficulties for the UK economy in the months ahead?
Well, there clearly are difficulties, and we've had a lot of problems with our banks, but so's the U.S. We've seen the U.S. government take that big stake in Citibank last week. So I think Gordon Brown will be saying, look, these are shared problems. Our two financial systems have been hit more badly than others around the world. But, I mean, I was in Japan last week, and their economy is sinking even faster. So this really is a global problem, and this will be Gordon Brown's message will be, look, we can get out of this together, or we can stay in this mess together. But above all, the U.S. has to lead not just in getting its own economy sorted out, but leading a global effort. I think that's an important message. And I think the British are fairly optimistic that Mr. Obama will listen, because the summit in London will be his first foreign trip, as it were,
right,
his first big summit. So he's going to want to, if you like, show the folks back home that he's made a success of it. That's what the British are hoping for anyway.
This is an official visit, not a state visit. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that actually Gordon Brown isn't a head of state. He's a head of government.
I see.
Here in the UK, we still have a queen who's our head of state. So we can't have state visits unless it's the queen.
I see. And who knows? Maybe she'll come because she's got all that money. You know, maybe she could make a deposit at AIG or something and help us all out.
I think even for the queen, times are tough.
Yes, indeed. Philip
she's
Stevens.
Got all those investments.
Indeed. Philip Stevens, associate editor of the Financial Times, joining us from London, talking about Gordon Brown visiting the White House today. He's going to sit down with President Obama at about 11:30 Eastern time, which is after we go off the air, but we'll report on all the details tomorrow. And again, the G20 summit, which Gordon Brown will be hosting, very much on the minds of Barack Obama and the Prime Minister of the UK, Gordon Brown. So let's look at the market numbers. Let's just look at the market numbers. The S&P dropped 4.7%. It is at its lowest level since November of 1996, bringing its losses for the year, just for the year, to about 22%. I saw yesterday that at one point during the day, the Dow Jones Industrial Average from its peak and the S&P 500 from its peak in October, I believe, of 2007, has fallen 54%. We want to welcome to the program Michael Hunter. We're grateful to have him here. He's the markets reporter for the Financial Times. The numbers being at these levels, 1997, 1996 numbers, Michael Hunter, what does this mean particularly? Are we finding a bottom here, or is this just a wholesale abandonment of equities as an investment option?
I think that's exactly the question, John, and I think it's a lack of clarity about which of those two options we're really facing at the moment, which is adding to the fragile confidence, which is in itself part of the problem that we're looking at. It's that lack of clarity and that lack of a see-through, if you will, which is making the market sell off all the more frightening this morning. We saw such big falls on the FTSE yesterday that we were able to enjoy a little bit of a bargain hunting bounce in early trade this morning. That's since been wiped out. Even some strong numbers in the banking sector from one of the UK banks focused on emerging Asian markets hasn't been able to steady the mood. And I think until we can see sentiment calming in the medium term and get a little bit of a clarity and a little bit of poise back, we could really go either way.
You know, the last time we spoke, there was a lot of movement in the market towards, you know, some sort of quality or a refuge, trying to find some sort of security. And the dollar was that for a time. And even U.S. equities were that for a time. But that seems to have gone away. I mean, you have a stock like General Electric, which is being viewed with the same sort of suspicion as Citigroup. It's trading down below, you know, 9 at this point.
Absolutely. And even having Citigroup in that kind of category for a shock stock is in itself a shock when you bear in mind how recently you and I would have been talking about a flight to quality really involving a company of the size and scope of Citigroup. And that tells its own story and gives us a great insight into what's been going on the markets in the past few months. But there is a certain element of hope out there in some respects. And I think people are now beginning to try and look to the medium term a little bit more. I still think there's room for optimism in parts of President Barack Obama's vision of dealing with some of the problems with these toxic assets from the roots upwards rather than from the tops of the toxic debt trees downwards. There's still people trying to come to terms with the kind of timescale that that might involve in terms of coming to more of a conclusion and more of a way in which we can pull out of this mess. And as that process continues and people start to look forward, we will in many ways, I suspect, start looking back to early March and late February of 2009 as perhaps the beginning of the end.
Hmm. Michael, this is Farai today. I just want to ask you specifically about Japan. The Nikkei is just taking a beating. We just had on Philip Stevens from the Financial Times saying that he'd been in Japan. There's been a financial relationship, between the U.S. and Japan, particularly around the auto industry. What ripple effect will that have on the U.S.?
I think in terms of Japan, the strengthening of the yen status as a safe haven currency, a steady bet, is of course hurting their export industry, which is of course so significant there, and so interlinked with its trading relationship with the US and with the way in which it does business globally as well. And it is of course very much one of the problems which we face at the moment is trying to work out exactly after this shakedown has happened how damaged those kind of relationships will be and what the prospects for the speed of the recovery will be when the markets and the investors within the markets can start assessing exactly what's changed.
Well, you say it very well, Michael Hunter, a complete reset of the financial relationships of the U.S. and Japan, a reset of the markets, a reset of the whole calculation of global value. I'd like to thank my guest, Michael Hunter. Michael Hunter is a markets reporter for the Financial Times. So a lot to talk about on the program. I want to remind you of a couple of things coming up. There's a law or there's a practice on the part of a newspaper in Memphis, Tennessee, to publish the names of individuals who carry concealed weapons, who actually have permits. They publish the names of people who have the permits. It's a public record in the state of Tennessee. It isn't in all states. What is the controversial impact of that on people who bear arms in your community? And would you endorse such a thing? Would you like to read in the paper that your neighbor actually is carrying a concealed weapon when you see him mowing the lawn or her, you know, taking the baby to school?
In some ways, it sounds like the sex offender registry, you know, just the idea of what is public and what is private and how does that affect our neighborhoods.
Well, they're certainly finding out in Tennessee, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. Also, Watchmen comes out. Is it nostalgia perfume ads that most is what you're looking forward to in the movie that is released on Friday? Watchmen, is it an obsession or a real statement of the end of the world? Think about it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. All that coming up.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. You know, it's not as though the issue of the right to bear arms, the Second Amendment, isn't a very public issue. It certainly was front and center when Wayne LaPierre, Executive Vice President and Chief Executive Officer of the NRA, spoke to the Conservative Political Action Committee conference last weekend in Washington, D.C.
So what does it mean when hardworking men and women postpone that new couch or that new set of tires for their car to invest in their own security? It means law-abiding Americans see the threats coming at them, and they're saying, I won't bet my life on the promises of politicians.
According to the NRA, there's a boom in gun sales. Law-abiding Americans are buying guns instead of couches or a new set of tires for their cars. The question is, should that be public? Should we know who buys guns and who has permits to carry concealed weapons? Well, Chris Peck, the editor of the Commercial Appeal, a Memphis newspaper, made the decision to publish on his newspaper's website in December of 2008 the names of people who have such permits. And so you could know in Memphis your neighbors if they actually carry concealed weapons. Here's editor Chris Peck.
We're not against Second Amendment. We're not against permit to carry in any way. We are for making sure that the government is transparent and accountable in what it does.
Accountability, transparency, and controversy. It was certainly the theme of the story Thomas Hargrove wrote, he's national correspondent for the Scripps Howard News Service, on the national implications of this. Thomas, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John. Hi, Pariah.
And let me just say, first of all, you work for the Scripps Howard News Service, which is also the owner of the Commercial Appeal newspaper, which made this decision. First of all, what are the national implications of this local newspaper decision?
It's prompting a debate in several state legislatures on whether or not these lists should be allowed to be a public record. They have been in 12 states for a good many years, and newspapers from time to time have published them. The Commercial Appeal did it the first time back in 1995.
So what has been the response in the community? Certainly gun owners are known to be political activists. You heard Wayne LaPierre speaking there at the top.
Well, the response has been, in some cases, quite dramatic and emotional. Quite a few editors in my company have had their lives threatened. In the case of the supervisors at the Commercial Appeal in Memphis, someone would post maps to show people how to find their homes. In other cases, we've had editors who've had pictures of their children posted online. Again, very ominous. And often associated directly with threats to life and safety.
Now, it is a permit to carry a concealed weapon. I mean, aren't you in some sense outing people who deliberately sought a permit to do something they didn't want everyone to know about?
Well, some people do and some people don't. It has been regarded a public record for several reasons. Advocates who say these records should be open do so because they say government often makes mistakes in who they give concealed weapon permits to. It is against the law for a felon to possess a weapon, much less have the right to carry a concealed weapon, and yet that's exactly what has happened over the years in Tennessee. A great many of these licenses, these permits, had to be revoked when news organizations disclosed that they were given to people with criminal records.
You know, let me just jump in here for a second. I remember that when Senator Obama became President Obama, there were a bunch of people who had actually voted for Obama but said, I don't know if he's going to change the gun laws, and they went out and loaded up. You know, the Lugers were selling out in gun stores across the country. Do we have a sense that that this effort to track guns is also related to fears either about crime in the economy or about potential legal changes in gun laws?
it does seem, as best we can tell, it does seem that the dramatic increase in the purchasing of weapons and the increase in the backlog of requests for concealed weapons permits probably has some foundation in fears that a new administration might take those rights away, although there's, to my knowledge, nothing pending about that. Also, of course, we're in a down economy, and there is a perception in many communities, including Memphis, Tennessee, that crime is on the rise.
You know, there is some dispute over whether the NRA's suspicion that gun sales are going through the roof is actually taking place. Certainly in some communities we've seen some dramatic pictures, but as a national trend, there is some dispute about that. On the question of, you know, the economy, do you think the newspaper is responding to these stories that people are purchasing more guns and that that could have an inflammatory, destabilizing impact on, say, the people in the community of Memphis?
Well, it's hard to know what impact the economy has on something like gun ownership or concealed weapons permitting. And frankly, in our business, the news business, there are forever unintended consequences. But how do we not talk about the economy? How do we not talk about the crime rate? How do we not talk about whether or not it's appropriate for concealed weapon permits to be a public record?
Just, you know, a quick sense. How are people reacting? Does this make newspapers relevant to people who have stopped reading?
Oh, we sure hope so. There are many, many causes for the decline in readership, including the ad models and people using the Internet and expecting news to be free. We have to do the best we can with all of that. But, you know, when a news organization takes a stand like publishing for a second or third time, which is what Memphis has done, the lists of concealed weapon permits. It does so to try to generate debate on whether it's appropriate, whether the state and the local sheriff's departments have been appropriate and who they grant concealed weapon permits to. And in many cases, it's been found that they were not appropriate.
Well, we love to stimulate debate here on the program. Thomas Hargrove, thanks so much for joining us. National correspondent for the Scripps Howard News Service, talking about the publishing of concealed weapon permit applications in the newspaper in Memphis, Tennessee. Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Thanks, John. The time just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner takes questions from the House Ways and Means Committee today. He will defend the Obama administration's proposed tax increases for next year's budget. Lawmakers from both parties are questioning the president's call to roll back on reductions for high-income earners. Two NFL players and a third man remain missing today as rescuers continue to search off the Florida coast where their boat capsized. Authorities say the men face dwindling odds of survival after more than 2 days in the water. Drug maker Pfizer will begin selling dozens more generic drugs in the United States and Europe. It's part of new deals with an Indian generic company and signals name brand drug makers' interest in expanding generic offerings. And the deals apply to drugs no longer under patent protection. As a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
That's an interesting reversal for Pfizer. Generics were, you know, not seen as a profit center for those companies, that's for sure. Thank you, Fem.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. I'm Farai Chidea in for Adora. And we're talking about something really interesting and just
This is great. In Watchmen, you can't believe what I just found. You can't.
John.
What?
John, reel it in. You interrupted me.
Oh,
you remind
me of
what I was talking about. In a few minutes, we're going to hear some surprising findings about how interruptions actually help you enjoy the task you're doing, like reading.
Interesting. In the meantime, what would you do if you had an entire hour without interruptions? I'll think about that. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. But we're following a disturbing story out of Pakistan this morning. Earlier today, gunmen attacked a bus carrying the Sri Lankan cricket team on its way to play in the Pakistani city of Lahore. It's an enormous story because of instability in Pakistan, civil war in Sri Lanka, and because cricket is a huge event in South Asia. To learn more, we spoke with BBC Pakistan correspondent Shoaib Hassan earlier this morning. I asked him what the latest situation was.
What I can tell you right now is that 7 policemen were killed while trying to protect the Sri Lankan players. Their bus was attacked early this morning by around a dozen gunmen who first tried to stop the bus, and then they used rocket-propelled grenades and automatic weapons to fire on the bus. 7 policemen were killed, and some of the Sri Lankan players have been injured in that attack.
What do you make of the suspicion, and I've seen it in a couple of reports, that the coordinated style of the attack is very reminiscent of what happened in Mumbai late last year?
Well, definitely, it was that type of attack. It was not a suicide bombing such as have been taking place in Pakistan over the last 2 years. It was a coordinated gun and automatic weapons attack. But these kinds of attacks have also taken place in Pakistan. Over the last 3 or 4 years, many high-profile figures in Pakistan, including the president Pervez Musharraf, former president Pervez Musharraf, has been the target of such attacks. So they are not uncommon in Pakistan.
What possible relationship could this have to the civil war in Sri Lanka between the Sinhalese government and the Tamil Tigers? I mean, it's hard for me to imagine an attack of this magnitude taking place on Pakistani soil from militants inside Sri Lanka, or maybe I'm mistaken here.
Well, I think that would be a really far-fetched possibility, the Tamil Tigers carrying out an attack in Pakistan's in eastern Pakistan. Lahore is located in eastern Pakistan. I think most of the suspicion has fallen on international jihadist groups. There has been a crackdown in Pakistan. A lot of the groups are not happy with how the Pakistani government has basically gone after them. So this could be a retaliation for the actions of the Pakistani government over the last year or so.
Shoaib, this is Farai Chidea. When I think of some of the news coming out of Pakistan, it's been about the border regions where Al-Qaeda operatives are said to really have sunk in. Is there a clear connection with the terrorist from the Mumbai attacks and possibly from this attack and what we in the U.S. think of as Al-Qaeda?
Well, it's still premature to say who is exactly behind these attacks. We have no clues. The security officials have said that they have taken 4 people into custody. Who these people are, we don't know. They might just be suspects who have been taken in for routine questioning. But generally, there is a pattern in these sort of attacks. This is not the first time this sort of attack has taken place in Lahore. And 9 out of 10 are traced back to Pakistan's, unfortunately, to Pakistan's tribal areas, and they have some sort of connection either with the Taliban or the Al-Qaeda.
So the Sri Lankan issue here may just be that the team was caught in a decision by militants to actually target cricket teams because there's such a high visibility of cricket in South Asia. I mean, is that possible here?
Yes, I mean, I think the whole the purpose of the exercise was to embarrass the Pakistani government, to show that Pakistan is not a safe place to come, and that outsiders should stay away, and that the Pakistani government is not in charge of the country. It cannot guarantee the security, anybody's security over here. So I think that was the whole point of the exercise, to show how much out of control the situation in Pakistan is.
Well, speaking of which, this is Farai again, there's also been a lot of talk about about the predator drones that the U.S. is using in these border regions. What's the reaction in Pakistan at large to generally how the U.S. is approaching some of these issues of violence and terrorism?
Well, there was this underlying strain of hostility against the United States since 2001. Over the last 2 years, that has been replaced by outright anti-Americanism. Nobody likes the American government in Pakistan. Generally, Americans were welcome, but now even ordinary Americans are not received very favorably in Pakistan. There is a lot of anti-Americanism. People feel that most of the security problems in Pakistan are because of the United States, are because of what is happening in Afghanistan and because of the United States actions in the border areas and in Afghanistan.
Well, instability is spilling over into events today. A very tragic situation with the Sri Lankan cricket team on their way to play in the city of Lahore in Pakistan, victims of a violent attack. Of the 12 gunmen, 4 are in custody. My guest was Shoaib Hassan, BBC Pakistan correspondent, who reported from Karachi earlier this morning. And now Femi Okeh is here with more headlines.
Thank you very much, John. The time just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, says that the United States will dispatch 2 envoys to Syria for preliminary talks. The move signals that the Obama administration may be willing to restore ties with Damascus. In Washington today, UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown will meet with President Obama. Now, just before his visit, the BBC's Kevin Connolly took a photograph around the streets of DC of Gordon Brown to see how many people knew him. This was a typical response.
He looks familiar.
He looks like an anchorman or something.
He does. Mm-hmm. No. Oh, who is he?
Prime Minister of Great Britain, Gordon Brown.
Oh, no, I would have known Tony Blair if I had saw his face.
I didn't know.
So, visibility is one of his issues. Bigger issue, though.
It's early for Gordon Brown.
Yes.
Give him a little
The economy. So the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, has been stressing for the need for the United States and UK to work together against the economic crisis. And he may well be laying the groundwork for a G20 economic summit in London that happens next month. Lawmakers will get their first chance to publicly question the Obama administration members on the proposed budget for 2010. The Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner will appear before the House Ways and Means Committee today, and lawmakers in both parties are questioning tax increases for high earners, and that's part of the proposal. And on the science beat, researchers have discovered a 300-million-year-old fossilized brain.
Mine?
That would explain a lot, but not yours. They were studying a type of fish that once lived in what is now Kansas and Oklahoma. A paleontology expert says that fossilized brains are unusual, and a recent discovery is by far the oldest known example. Chuckling away at your own joke there.
Your joke.
I'd like mine put in a jar.
Jar? Because that would be a pickled brain, yeah. So pickled brain there. Pickled or fossilized. We love brains here on The Takeaway. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I am Farai Chidea in for Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. We're joined by James Painter, BBC Latin American analyst for the BBC World Service, to get some insight into a political shakeup in Cuba. President Raul Castro replaced 11 officials. It happened yesterday. It ousted politicians linked to his brother Fidel. Does it signal a new era for Cuba? Is it a reshuffle that was in the cards since Raul took over? The question goes to James Painter. James, what do you think? This is sort of expected, don't you think?
Well, it was expected that he was going to do some sort of shakeup. He'd said for some time he was going to streamline the ministries. I think what's surprising is that 2 key allies or confidants of Fidel have been removed. The foreign minister for almost a decade, Felipe Perez Roque, and Carlos Laje has been replaced as cabinet secretary. So I think what it really is Raul stamping his own imprimatur, if you like, on his cabinet and his top officials.
So this is a personality paring back to get rid of characters from the old era, looking forward to the new, but it's also a vote against big government in Cuba, it sounds like.
Oh, I wouldn't go that far. I don't think it's a vote against big government. He wants to make the political and economic system more efficient. And he's streamlining a number of the ministries. The key question is, what does these changes mean for the future direction, particularly of the Cuban economy? If you remember, he has talked a lot about introducing some small-scale reforms to the Cuban economy to make it more efficient. What will these changes mean? Will it mean that the reforms, particularly in the agricultural sector, particularly on salary ceilings, are those going to be introduced more easily now with his own people, or is there still going to be delays on these promises that he's made to the Cuban people?
Well, we don't have a whole lot of time here, but let's break that into two pieces then. To looking around today, what's the average Cuban citizen to make of this? Is it likely to affect them? And what are the nations in the region likely to think of this change quickly?
Well, very quickly, I was in Cuba at the beginning of last month, and certainly, at least in Havana, people wanted to see economic changes to improve their lot. Remember that the average wage is about $20 a month, and they're desperate for changes that will give them a better standard of living. In the region, I don't think it will have a huge impact. Very briefly, Raul, over the last 12 months, has mended relations with a number of Latin American countries. The key to the future is what's going to happen in terms of relations with the U.S.
And what about Venezuela? Certainly, Hugo Chavez thinks of Cuba as his best friend in the region. Is that reciprocated?
Oh, yes, very much so. The Cuban economy is dependent on subsidies of Venezuelan oil to the tune of around $4 billion is the best guesstimate a year. And that relationship will remain very close.
And finally, you know, $20 a month is the wage in Cuba. What tangibly can be done to improve that by this new sort of shakeup or by Raul?
Well, there are a number of questions. Is he going to lift, as I said, the ceiling on salaries to allow people to earn more, particularly in the state sector? Is he going to allow more small-scale businesses to improve income in a number of sectors, from particularly the agricultural sector, but, say, small businesses as well?
All right, and we'll have to see if that transpires over the next several months. James Painter, BBC Latin American analyst for the BBC World Service, joining us from London. Thanks, James.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Find out how, exactly how, I'm going to get even more pleasure from the segment coming up because, that's right, because Femi Oke is going to interrupt me right now with the headlines.
I just actually scrolled up to see what pleasurable segment was coming up next. Aha, okay, I see what you're looking at. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, everybody. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says that the United States will vigorously push for the creation of a Palestinian state.
I personally am very committed to this, and I know that it can be done. I believe that with all my heart.
So this is Secretary Clinton's first trip to the Middle East as the top U.S. diplomat. She's meeting with the Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu today, and Secretary Clinton pledged that the U.S. would work with the new Israeli government. The Justice Department released secret legal papers yesterday written during the Bush administration. They included insertions that the president could use the military to combat suspected terrorists within the U.S. without obtaining search warrants. Another memo says the president could move prisoners to other countries where they might have faced torture. 9 documents were released. The number of people making late mortgage payments shot up 53% in the fourth quarter last year. That's compared with the same time a year ago. Credit reporting agency TransUnion says that nearly 5% of mortgage holders are at least 60 days late. And while we're talking about figures, I want to take a moment to acknowledge the mathematicians who are celebrating Square Root Day. They are partying like it's 3309. Whoopee. Today is that...
Hey.
Okay.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, I know. Today is that, that's why it's in the news. Today is that rare day that occurs when the day and the month are both the square root of the last two digits of the current year. Square root day occurs only 9 times in a century.
That's right. So it's a big deal.
We are lucky to be alive, let
it's
me tell you.
It's a huge deal.
The next one is April the 4th to 2016. So I'll make a note of that and put it in the news that day.
Have made my plans.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. I'm
3309, square root day.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So we all get interrupted every day. Our devices interrupt us. People interrupt us. But are you the interrupted or the interrupter?
I'm both an interrupter and the victim of interruptions, mostly at work. I'm a nurse, and docs are constantly asking questions. You can't ever finish your paperwork. And at home, my husband works from home. Oftentimes, I interrupt him from his work. She helps me around the kids, around the house.
So maybe you're the interrupter or the interrupted. We all know how it goes. Your cell phone rings, someone walks into a room. What impact does this have on your brain? New research suggests that however annoying those interruptions seem, they may actually be enhancing your appreciation for what you're doing and the way the brain responds. Here to tell us more is Benedict Carey, science reporter for the New York Times, who has a story on the psychology of interruptions in today's Science Times. Welcome back to the program, Ben.
Thanks very much.
Now, interruptions, why did you, first of all, tackle this? It seems like a gigantic issue in relationships and the question of how we speak politically, how we get through our day because of all these electronic devices. What made you decide to look into the science of it?
Well, there was some interesting research presented at a recent psychology conference. I don't think interruptions have been studied all that much at all. It happens all the time. It's one of those everyday things where you don't even think about it. And so it was interesting in its own right just that someone was looking at that. They looked at the – I reported on some research in which they looked at interruptions in the context of TV commercials and found that commercials enhance the viewing experience. You enjoy shows more when you have commercial interruptions versus when you don't. And so this was such a sort of a strange finding that I thought it was worth writing about or looking at.
So you like the show less if you TiVo it and get rid of the commercials than if you actually watched it on the broadcast network in its original context with the interruptions?
Not quite right. Most people, when they TiVo, they make their own interruptions. You stop, you go to the bathroom, you go get something to eat, someone comes into the room, you stop, you rewind. And so in a sense, those are ideal interruptions because you have control over them. What they were looking at is TV shows interrupted by commercials or shown continuously where you essentially sit there and watch the whole thing through.
Well, Benedict, this is Farai Chidea. It strikes me that this is completely counterintuitive. And what does it say to you about human psychology that in some cases we find it pleasurable to be interrupted, when, you know, the whole protocol around interruption is usually that you're aggravated, that you are the star of your life and people are just getting in your way?
Right. Well, I think it makes more sense when you think of other ways that we can enjoy interruption. You know, we put off some pleasures. You know, we space out our drinks or our cigarettes through the day, our calls to our friends. I was thinking of it even in terms of when you get together with a good friend and you have a conversation, you're interrupting each other all the time. It's sometimes the most kind of fun conversation there is. And so I think when you think of it in that context, sort of broadly, that we like to save our pleasures sometimes. And then when you look at it sort of moment to moment in a TV program, starts to make a little more sense. The problem, of course, is that some commercials are so annoying that,
right,
you know, you just think
it's
crazy.
Out.
Yeah.
So that delayed gratification theory that you're talking about here, does that work even if you're talking about electronic devices that get in your way, that shift your focus away from, say, reading a book?
Well, it's a good question. I would expect so. I think that's what they would probably say. I mean, the sort of the psychology behind this is that we adapt to the experience we're having. So if we're watching a show, we're enjoying the show, we adapt to that, and so the more we watch, the sort of the less pleasing it is. It sort of diminishes in its returns as we're watching. And so to interrupt it, we kind of go back to zero, and it becomes sort of as enjoyable as it was when we first turned it on. So if you keep sort of running the meter back to zero, you get that effect.
Hmm.
So that's the way they sort of explain this. Now, they also found sort of the converse or the opposite, that if you're doing something dreary or miserable, interrupting that experience can make it seem, you know, more dreary.
More dreary.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask a personal question.
Yeah.
What is your worst case scenario for being interrupted? What would drive you completely out of your mind?
You can talk about your editor. It's okay.
Right. What would drive me completely out of my mind? You know, I guess if you're looking, you're talking about the Friday night martinis are pretty important. So, you know, that can be interrupted and it drives you a little bit nuts.
So late deadline, you got to stay at work.
Right, late deadline for sure.
Yeah. That's nasty. Well, then, you know, this sort of gets to the question kind of backhandedly. What is the value to our brain of focused, immersive activity where we don't deviate, where we don't get interrupted, where we don't even interrupt ourselves, where we just really drive into something? Maybe it's playing the piano or the violin.
Well, that's a good question, and that's a different experience than the one they're looking at. The things they're looking at are fairly mild, more passive than what you're talking about. The experience you're describing, and there's a whole literature and research on that, some people call it flow, where you get engrossed, you lose yourself in something, a very engaging task. You're doing some music, you're a craft or something like that. And in those cases, I think most of the psychologists agree that interruption's probably a bad idea. Because it does break the thread, and it breaks that experience.
But not completely bad. Benedict Carey, thanks so much for joining us. He's a New York Times science reporter who has an article in today's Science Times about focus and interruption. It's kind of an interesting takeaway. We think of our brains as being in a natural state of focus, but in fact, we are adapted to be interrupted. It's sort of a good thing sometimes.
I know I have many little boxes in my brain, like, you know, Windows or, you know, the browser. And, you know, when the interruption comes, it's just like a little flashing box.
So actually, you were the author of Excel. It's based on your brain?
Absolutely.
Excellent. Microsoft Excel. We're always on at The Takeaway. Farai Chidea is joining me all week with her Excel-like computer brain. Of course, so we were just talking about interruptions. Mark Fay writes us and says, I've been interrupted daily and didn't even know it until today. I live in Massachusetts and have gotten The Takeaway on WGBH Boston since you came on the radio on WGBH. I've been listening for 1 hour a day, but I just found out you're on for 4 hours. Now I'm listening to you for those 3 hours after 7 a.m., so I guess now everything I should have been doing between 7 and 10 has been interrupted. Hey.
Woo-woo!
We are grateful for the interruption. We had a really interesting conversation this morning about concealed weapons and whether the state should publish the names of people in your community who carry concealed weapons, who actually have the permits.
Hey, this is Greg in Dartmouth, Mass. If my neighbor has a concealed weapon permit, that's fine with me. I wouldn't mind learning that. That means he's been thoroughly vetted by the police department and is not a felon and is probably a pretty upstanding guy.
What do you think? Dan writes an email to say there is no reason to list folks to the public with concealed weapons. Find a list of your neighbors who have used a handgun in a crime and let us have that list. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We are on for 4 hours a day. You can listen to us anywhere online at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Watchmen comic book author lays down the challenge.
So, in a sense, I suppose that you could say that most of my work from the 80s onwards was more or less designed to be unfilmable.
Unfilmable? Hollywood takes up the challenge. Alan Moore's Watchmen is on film. The movie comes out on Friday. The end of the world approaches. Who can save us? Who can save us? That's easy. The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everybody. It's Tuesday, March 3rd, 2009, Square Root Day. I'm John Hockenberry. Farai Chidea is in for Adore Udoji, who's spending time with her new baby. Good morning, Farai.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about what Washington spending is going towards. We'll also check in on the political situation in the West African nation of Guinea-Bissau, where their president was assassinated yesterday. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Jerusalem today. She's expressing her support for the new Israeli government and says rocket fire from militants in Gaza must stop.
There is no doubt that any nation, including Israel, cannot stand idly by while its territory and people are subjected to rocket attacks.
Earlier today, Clinton said the U.S. will dispatch envoys to Syria, two of them. It's a sign the Obama administration may be ready to mend relations with Damascus. In Washington, U.K. Prime Minister Gordon Brown will meet with President Obama today. The prime minister has been stressing the need for coordinated action in the midst of the economic crisis. The meeting comes as Brown prepares to chair a G20 economic summit in London next month. Farai?
Before the president meets the U.K. prime minister, he'll speak at the Department of Transportation this morning, during which time he will highlight spending on transportation in the stimulus plan. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and Budget Director Peter Orszag will appear before the House today to defend the proposed 2010 budget. It's Congress's first chance to publicly question the Obama administration about the budget. Meanwhile, the Senate will hear from Federal Chair Ben Bernanke on the long-term impact of the president's proposals. And senior administration officials say that President Obama sent a secret letter to Russian President Dmitry Medvedev last month. The letter suggests an agreement with which the U.S. would back off from deploying a new missile defense system in Eastern Europe if Russia would help prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. President Medvedev said today that he was ready to cooperate with Washington, but Moscow says the letter didn't offer any such trade-off.
Right now, the Dow futures are poised to bounce back today when Wall Street opens in about 30 minutes. Of course, the Dow was below 7,000 yesterday for the first time since May 1st, 1997. Both the indices fell more than 4% yesterday. The Dow opens today at 67.63. The S&P starts trading a smidge above 700 at 701. We'll be watching the markets. They'll be open in about 30 minutes. So it's kind of an obsession. Watchmen, the graphic novel, comes to the screen, even though Alan Moore, the author, a co-author of the fantastic, apocalyptic, dark graphic novel of all time, says it's unfilmable. What do you think? Has the Watchmen apocalypse come and gone, or is it still looming? We're all nerds here in this studio. Call us 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Watchmen.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Farai Chidea is here in the studio, and for Adore Udoji. Good morning, Farai.
How you doing?
Very well, very well. So you got your stimulus. There's $700 billion or so. You got your $700 billion bank bailout. But who can possibly keep track of the fact that the government actually has to fund itself? That's the budget. That's a whole other set of billions. And
let alone regulate.
Exactly. I mean, Congress needs to actually pass a budget of $410 billion. Out the White House door. It's called the Omnibus Spending Bill. It's actually a budget of sorts. What Barack Obama announced last week was the budget for next year. The Omnibus Spending Bill is just keeping the government going this year. It's the funding for federal agencies like the Department of Agriculture, Health and Human Services, Justice Department, all the agencies that are essential to the everyday functioning of the U.S. government. So why has Senator John McCain gotten himself in such a huff like he was yesterday on Capitol Hill?
Unnecessarily and wasteful earmarks. So much for the promise of change, Mr. President. So much for the promise of change.
Thank you, Senator. Now, whether you call them pork or earmarks or congressional mandated spending, that's what Harry Reid actually does call it. The enemies of earmarking are all fired up this week. One more time for Senator McCain.
$951,500 for a sustainable Las Vegas. What does that mean? $6.6 million for termite research in New Orleans. $2.1 million for the Center for Grape Genetics in New York. $1.7 million for a honeybee factory.
So there's probably only one person in Washington who loves to talk about earmarks more than Senator John McCain, and that, of course, is our man on Capitol Hill, Todd Zwillick, reporter for Capitol News Connection. This is not the change we need, but it was definitely the theme on Capitol Hill. Todd, good morning.
Hey, good morning, John. How's it going?
Great. Todd, meet Farai.
Hi, Farai.
Hello.
So,
hello.
Earmarks. It's all earmarks yesterday on Capitol Hill. And looking at the omnibus spending bill, it seems like, change we need is not enough to get earmarks out of the omnibus spending bill.
Well, the John McCain has for his entire career railed against earmarks, John. Some of the change this year is that his anger level seems to have been ratcheted up. He's always passionate about them. He was really angry on the floor yesterday. I think he'll continue to be this week. So the number of earmarks in this bill, and we need to talk a little bit about one person's earmark, one person's pork project versus another person's worthy program.
Exactly.
And I'm sure we will talk about that. But according to Taxpayers for Common Sense, one of the best spending and earmark watchdog groups here in Washington, this omnibus spending bill is $410 billion, contains 8,570 earmarks total for a total of about $7.7 billion. That's the total. And it does. It ranges from everything from termite research in New Orleans, like Senator McCain said, pig odor mitigation in Iowa, which if you lived in Iowa, that might be something that you want some federal money for, I would imagine.
Sure.
Grape genetics in New York is courtesy of Chuck Schumer, senator from New York. So those things sound egregious, but there are lots and lots, dozens, hundreds of different kinds of earmarks, some of them, to the casual observer, to the spreadsheet reader, more worthy than others.
But explain to me, again, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with Senator McCain, but it does seem to be a little bit like low-hanging fruit. I mean, anything as big as a $410 billion spending bill is going to have some small items that, taken out of context, look a little ridiculous.
It will. And, of course, he takes the most ridiculous and egregious ones and takes them to the floor and lists them off. The ones you won't hear Senator McCain and his allies talk about probably are the ones that most people would probably think are probably pretty worthy. If you look, for instance, in the labor, HHS, education, appropriations section of the omnibus, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of individual earmarks for health clinics and hospitals for equipment and ongoing operations. And if you talk to members about this, they will tell you that these are health clinics that served underserved areas, minorities, rural areas, what have you, inner cities, that often can't make margin without help from their local member of Congress getting them earmarks. And most people would probably say that's worthy. I would say Senator McCain would say that that's worthy. But in those cases, he has a problem with the process. Why aren't they vetted the way all the rest of the spending is? Why do individual members who have clout get to put them in the bill?
Todd, do you know anything about the senator's position on earmarks? Has he been someone who has avoided them in his long time in the Senate, or has he also dipped into the well at certain points?
Well, Senator McCain being against earmarks has been one of the hallmarks of John McCain's entire political career. I don't know the exact answer to your question, Farai. I don't know if he earmarked back before things like the Keating scandal happened that he got involved in, when he really took on more of a champion of ethics mantle. He does not earmark now and has not for years. He's one of very few members of Congress who don't earmark. Tom Coburn from Oklahoma does not. John Boehner, the Republican leader in the House, does not. But the vast majority of Republicans and Democrats do earmark. The earmarks in this omnibus bill are 60-40 Democrat to Republican. Right. So lots of Republicans earmark. All appropriators earmark. This is the hallmark of their power, their clout from back home.
In some ways, it's how things get done. We should remind people, you referred to the Keating 5 scandal. That, of course, was at the beginning of the SNL crisis, the savings and loan crisis, where John McCain was linked to a savings and loan that eventually failed and lost money for lots of people. He disassociated himself with that and claimed that he learned a lesson. So speaking of learning lessons, though, whether you're talking stimulus or earmark, earmarks. The question of how things gets done in Washington is really on the table. I wonder if you could listen to Wayne LaPierre, the executive vice president and chief executive officer of the National Rifle Association of America, speaking at the Conservative Political Action Committee conference last week in Washington, D.C. He's attempting to put a stimulus tinge on an old issue. See if you don't admire this as much as I do, Todd.
Boy, I'll tell you, you've read it in the papers. We're watching the marvelous machinery of Second Amendment freedom at work in this country like never before. In one of the worst economies in our lifetimes, gun sales are the highest on record in this country.
And that's not all. Then he goes on, Wayne LaPierre does, to actually explain how it works economically to produce actual stimulus, this buying of guns.
So what does it mean when hardworking men and women postpone that new couch or that new set of tires for their car to invest in their own security? It means law-abiding Americans see the threats coming at them, and they're saying, I won't bet my life on the promises of politicians.
So did you hear the person in the back saying, yeah, right. Here's Wayne LaPierre saying that people are postponing consumer purchases to buy guns in this economy. It's good for guns, but it's an indication that the economy is off track.
They're getting the spirit over there at the NRA. I guess that was at CPAC. Yeah. Interesting thing about the NRA, while we're on it, it's not quite the stimulus. But let's point out really quickly, you're there in New York. Kirsten Gillibrand, the new senator, had a 100% voting record with the NRA up until last week. She voted no on the amendment that would have eviscerated D.C.'s gun laws on the D.C. voting rights bill, her very first anti-gun vote in Congress, because she has to run downstate in 2010. She's no longer just representing Glens Falls and Albany. She has to run in New York City. You don't want a 100% NRA voting record down there, John. So,
that's an interesting point.
Yeah, keep that in mind. A little off topic. We're talking about the economy and earmarks, but Wayne LaPierre has influence in some places and not so much in others.
Yeah, well, it is all about positioning. And do you see Democrats and beginning to position themselves as friends of big government in these negotiations over the budget, and conservatives trying to produce a sort of stimulus message out of some of its traditional tax and spend kind of arguments as we look forward?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's hard to say, because a lot of the Capitol Hill crunching over the budget, the FY10 budget, hasn't really started yet. A lot of it will start today. Peter Orszag, the White House budget director, comes up today to start to defend the FY2010 budget in the House Budget Committee, and Bernanke will be in the Senate. So those things will start to happen. Really, people are casting this omnibus bill, the one we're talking about, as last year's business. And you'll be hearing all week Republicans angrily saying, well, President Obama, when he campaigned, even when he was talking about the economic recovery package, bragged that it was free of earmarks and that he's against earmarks. Why does this bill have 8,600 earmarks?
Right.
And they say it's last year's business. Let's finish it and move on. And John, by the way,
yep,
they would say that very quickly. Some former members of Congress who have earmarks in this bill, Ray LaHood, Hilda Solis, Rahm Emanuel, sound familiar?
Oh, sure. Interesting.
All in the administration.
All in the administration.
Not members
now
of Congress anymore. There are more than a dozen former members of Congress, not even members anymore,
who have earmarks that are in the administration. Todd Zwilla, Capital News Connection, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
For all you need to know, go, go, Todd Zwilla.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Is it a reveal or is it more of an indication of the style of deal-making in tradecraft, statecraft under the Obama administration? It's a story in the New York Times this morning, a revelation brought to light by Peter Baker, New York Times reporter, who we are grateful to have back on the program. Apparently, President Obama sent a secret letter to Russia's president last month suggesting that there would be a possible quid pro quo of deploying a new missile system in Eastern Europe. The U.S., if it backed off on that, would be interested in Moscow's help in helping to stop Iran from developing long-range weapons. Peter Baker, is that about the sort of gist of the story that you published this morning?
The letter that President Obama sent to the Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, was meant to sort of reopen or part of the effort to reset push the reset button, as Vice President Biden has put it, in the relationship between the United States and Russia. And one thing he said in there is, look, if Iran didn't have long-range ballistic missiles and a nuclear weapons capacity, then we don't need this missile defense that you're so against in Eastern Europe. So you have an incentive to do something more significant to actually help us stop Iran from developing these kinds of weapons. It's not direct quid pro quo, but the linkage was made in the letter in a way that is intended to get Moscow more fully on board with Washington's efforts to keep Iran from developing these weapons.
There's an irony here, Peter, in the sense that the technology for an anti-missile defense system is perceived as dubious by most defense analysts, even though it is controversial in its deployment in Eastern Europe. And the ability of Iran to actually deploy a long-range weapons capability is also the subject of some dispute. Yet this letter is a very interesting sort of front page story on the news between the U.S. and Russia. Resolve those for me.
So I think part of it suggests is that the Obama administration is not, you know, as enthusiastic about the idea of missile defense as the Bush administration was. It's not their project. Costs a lot of money, as you say. The technology is still yet to be fully proved. So they are not as wedded to the idea if there's some, something to be gained in backing off of it, then they wouldn't mind gaining something like that. After all, the incentive for this is intended to be to guard against an Iranian threat. So, you know, this is one more indication that policy might change, that there's going to be a different attitude toward both Russia and missile defense and possibly even Iran by the new administration.
Peter, what's your sense about the economics of this? Certainly the U.S. right now can't really afford much of anything, although we are sort of fishing money out of thin air. Russia has had its own economic ups and downs, and as you say, military hardware is extremely expensive. Do you have any sense of what their perspective is on this financially?
Oh, what the Russian perspective is?
Yes.
Well, the Russians, you know, have threatened repeatedly to find ways to counter any missile defense system they put in Eastern Europe. I mean, never mind that the plan, as conceived by President Bush, really was only for 10 interceptors in Poland, which would never be a threat to Russia because they have, you know, 1,000 strategic warheads. But the Russians have talked about this starting a new arms race, which is something that they can't afford any more than we can. So, you know, if there's some way to find accommodation, I think both sides would like to do it. There has been talk in the past about Russia joining this missile defense system, to do it together, perhaps putting one of the facilities in Russia. I think that's something that the Obama team is sort of rethinking right now, whether that might be something that might be workable. There are some real problems with that, but it would suggest a different level of relationship.
So it's something that they would have to respond to if the missiles were deployed, but it's an expense they would probably love to not have to actually put up if push came to shove here. Let's talk about the characterization of the letter from the Russian perspective, continuing with the sort of Russian view of this. Do the Russians say this was a deal, a quid pro quo, a trade-off of missiles for missiles?
No, I mean, I think that they look at it as a statement of of opening by the new Obama administration. I mean, this letter is a broad letter talking about the relationship in a lot of different levels. Talk about opening supply routes to Afghanistan. Talks about negotiating an extension of the strategic arms treaty that expires in December. And I think that they're not going to look at it or call it a direct quid pro quo either, because it's that's sort of unseemly and it's not framed in that way. But they understand the message, and they've been talking about it in Moscow clearly as well. A Russian paper yesterday reported on this and discussed it as a very sensational part of this letter. So it's certainly on their minds, and a Russian official told me yesterday that Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, will be bringing his own ideas about missile defense to Geneva when he meets with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on Friday.
Just very, very briefly, we watched a lot about Georgia, the state of Georgia, and Russia and their clash. How much is Russia right now facing challenges with even conventional weapons against people who used to be part of the Soviet Union?
Sure, absolutely. They, their neighbors, Georgia, Ukraine in particular, the Latvian, Lithuanian, and Estonians in the Baltics, feel very threatened by Russia. And in fact, one last thing I'll mention is that Poland, which is going to be the station for one of these interceptor projects of ours, demanded American Patriot batteries be stationed there. That's something that's going to be on the table as well, whether the Obama administration would go forward with that.
All right, Peter, thanks so much. New York Times reporter Peter Baker joined us from Washington, D.C. Early contacts between Barack Obama and President Medvedev in Russia. Now, Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Thank you very much. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour, talking about Gordon Brown and President Obama. They will be meeting in D.C. today to talk about global solutions to the economic crisis. He may be laying the groundwork, that's Gordon Brown, for a G20 economic summit in London next month. And tomorrow, the UK Prime Minister will become the fifth British Prime Minister to address Congress. In Pakistan, at least a dozen men ambushed a Sri Lankan cricket team with rifles, grenades and rocket launchers. The team was driving to a stadium in Lahore for a match. Six policemen and a driver were killed. Seven players, their coach and an umpire were wounded. It's one of the worst terrorist attacks on a sports team since Palestinian militants killed 11 Israeli athletes at the 1972 Munich Olympics. The number of people late on their mortgage payments shot up 53% in the fourth quarter last year. That's compared to the same amount of people the previous year. Credit reporting agency TransUnion says that nearly 5% of mortgage holders are at least 60 days late. It says that delinquency rates could reach as high as 8% by the end of the year. And more than a dozen gay couples are filing a federal lawsuit in Massachusetts today because they say that a federal law on marriage is discriminatory. Let's look at big stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. A couple of things. Money is flowing. Wall Street is open, bouncing off the bottom. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up about 75 points, possibly in reaction to the Federal Treasury injecting so-called TALF money into the financial sector to get institutions and banks particularly to lend to consumers. Also, Watchmen. It comes out at the end of the week. The reviews haven't been great, but that doesn't mean people still aren't obsessed with it, like myself and Farai Chidea, who is here in the studio. What do you think?
Mark from the Bronx. You know, Watchmen still is relevant to today, especially the ending, which I don't want to ruin, but the fact is, to unify the world under a great crisis works, but only for a short period of time, as evident in 9/11 and how it unified the world and ourselves, and we squandered that unity and now we're back to where we were. So it's still a relevant movie.
But not necessarily a happy movie. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We reported yesterday on the violence in Mexico between the government of Felipe Calderon, who's attempting to take control back from drug cartels that have long had free reign in Mexico. And this is what it sounds like in the English-speaking news world.
Major threat on the border with Mexico because of a widening drug war.
Drug cartels are battling throughout the city.
They're terrorizing the country with very public acts of violence.
Juarez, where the violence has been especially brutal.
A group of Mexican soldiers was found with their heads cut off.
1,600 people killed in this city last year. Juarez police officers are fighting for their lives. Beheaded, tortured, strafed with bullets.
People in El Paso, Texas, don't need to turn on their televisions to know what's going on across the border. In many cases, they can see signs of the violence from their own windows and backyards. Joining us now is Carlos Spector, who's an El Paso-based immigration attorney, to talk about what is one of the consequences. People seeking refuge, political asylum in the United States because of the drug violence across the border. Carlos Spector, thanks for joining us. And how has this had an impact on the very work that you do on, immigration law?
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you from El Paso. Yeah, I've been handling Mexican asylum cases since the early 1990s, and as of April or May of last year, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of Mexicans seeking asylum, from journalists to police and women. And, of course, the increased violence in May and April, everyone's tracing that with the advent of the Mexican military to the north in a program called Conjunto Chihuahua, which is sending thousands of troops to the north to deal with the drug trafficking crime. And the problem with that is that the military is part of the problem. When you talk about drug trafficking, there are no good guys in this movie. This is like an Abbott and Costello movie when you have the choice between Frankenstein, Dracula, and the werewolves. Frankenstein is the local police, which is big, slow, and brutish, but they work all day and all night. Dracula comes out at night only, but he's pretty slick. And the werewolf, which is the military, is strong, vicious, agile, and the best assassin. But it only comes out once a month with the full moon. And that's the guy that the U.S. is supporting in this battle, the werewolf, the least of three evils. But you have the military supporting one cartel, the Sinaloa cartel. You have the state of Chihuahua supporting the Juarez cartel. And then you have the local police and commander of the police station also supporting the military. So you have these internecine fights, but each level of government is supporting a drug trafficking cartel. Mexico is Charles Bowden, a great book on the border, states that Mexico is the country where everybody understands and no one knows. And what I am enunciating to you is what the press has not picked up on and what the U.S. government doesn't want to look at, because the good guys in this movie is the military, and they feel they have no other option. But we've seen a drastic spike of human rights violations by the Mexican government, which we are now viewing as Pinochet on crack cocaine.
Wow.
I just wanted to bring up something. The New York Times recently did a story about how Mexico's drug laws, and this was their story, are tougher than the U.S. ones. And there's a lot of smuggling of a lot of smuggling of guns across the border from the U.S. into Mexico, which seems counterintuitive to, you know, a lot of folks. What's your take on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the guns are flowing into Mexico, and the drug laws in Mexico are pretty tough, but so are their labor rights, and so is their constitution. It's in the implementation of the laws, and that's really part of the problem in terms of perceiving Mexican reality. It's such a different, surrealistic reality that to try to view it through American eyes, I think, distorts their reality. And our solutions.
Well, it's a cultural war, and that's been described a number of times on the program. Before we go, Carlos, how is this not economic refugees attempting to seek another pathway into the United States, noting the violence in the border, versus people who actually have a claim for political asylum?
Yeah, that's a great question. Now, quite frankly, some of it, and to a large degree, there are a lot of economic refugees who are seeking political refuge, but they don't qualify. In order to qualify for political asylum, you've got to be fleeing state persecution on the basis of your political opinion or membership in a particular social group. And if it's not the state, you got to show that the state can't protect you. For example, what we're seeing is the massive flow of women fleeing domestic violence, which is a social group that's protected under refugee law because of the historic abuse of women in Mexico, compounded by the lawlessness and the narco-trafficking culture, which is really submitting women to a lesser role.
Well, they're certainly putting them in a violent situation. That's a great example, but we're going to leave it there. Carlos Spector, El Paso-based immigration attorney, thank you so much. That's a pretty terrific analysis involving werewolves, Dracula, and Frankenstein, all about the lawlessness below the border and the spike in immigration and political asylum claims here in the United States. Thanks, Carlos. And Femi Oke has the headlines.
Hello, good morning. Just keeping an eye on the markets. Look like the S&P and the Dow both are up, just as the markets opened in the last 8 or 9 minutes or so. In other news, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is in Jerusalem today. She said that the U.S. will dispatch 2 envoys to Syria. It's a sign that the Obama administration is ready to mend relations with Damascus. The U.S. withdrew its ambassador from Syria in 2005, saying the country supported terrorism. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and Budget Director Peter Orszag will appear before the House today to defend the proposed 2010 budget. It's Congress's first chance to publicly question the Obama administration about the budget. And meanwhile, the Senate will hear from Federal Chair Ben Bernanke on the long-term impact of the president's proposals. Now, was anybody up early enough this morning to watch Jimmy Fallon's first attempt?
Missed it.
You missed it. He made his late-night debut last night. The star-studded lineup included Robert De Niro and Justin Timberlake. And, of course, Jimmy Fallon is replacing Conan O'Brien, who's replacing Jay Leno, who's moving to the 10 p.m. slot in the fall on NBC.
It's like a shake-up in Cuba, you know? It's just a total shake-up, a complete power shake-up. Yes, thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. There's continuing turmoil in the West African nation of Guinea-Bissau, where the president is dead after renegade soldiers shot him yesterday. The soldiers blame the president for the bomb blast that killed the army chief of staff one day earlier. Guinea-Bissau's president, João Bernardo Vieira, had ruled intermittently since 1980. And joining us now, we've got Will Ross, the BBC's correspondent for West Africa, to fill us in. So what exactly happened yesterday?
Well, it's an extraordinary few hours. The president, as you mentioned, João Bernardo Vieira, was killed in his home. Soldiers from the army came along and apparently threw a bomb through the window initially, which partly destroyed the building. And then he came out of the rubble and was shot dead. Apparently, he was then taken away by soldiers and his body was badly mutilated. Now, just a few hours before that, the head of the armed forces, a man called General Tagmin Awai, he died in a bomb blast in the army headquarters. And the two events are linked. The two men have had a history of bad blood. There's been a lot of problems between the two men, especially in recent months. But it goes back also many years because the president himself, as you mentioned, he's been in power a long time, but he was ousted back in 1999. And the general was partly supposed to have been behind that ousting.
Guinea-Bissau is a country that is perhaps overshadowed by its regional neighbors in West Africa. How's this rippling through the region?
Well, I think that the region has really borne the brunt of the instability in Guinea-Bissau for decades, since the 70s when it got its independence. I mean, Guinea-Bissau is a desperately poor country, and it's had so many coups and problems that the other countries all around there are continually sort of looking across the border and wondering where the country's heading to. So that's why today a large group of foreign ministers from the region have gone to Guinea-Bissau, and they are under the auspices of the West African Regional Body, ECOWAS, and they're going to go and talk to the politicians and, more importantly, talk to the military and send out this message that the military has to stay out of politics. But at the moment, there's a prime minister that's supposed to be taking over power. The Speaker of Parliament is supposed to be taking over power, and elections should be held within 60 days. But that'll be quite a tall order.
Will, just one more thing. It strikes me that this nation only got independence in 1974 after a civil war, and that the president, now dead, was one of those fighters. Is there a culture of violence that sort of flash forward from those days of warfare?
Well, some analysts will tell you that really since the battle for independence, and it's the only country in the region that actually fought for independence and won it through a war, the country hasn't really moved on. The army is still intertwined in the politics, and that's really the crux of the problem.
Well, Will Ross, BBC correspondent for West Africa, thank you so much.
Sure.
It's a test of ECOWAS, who, of course, had an enormous role to play in Liberia. The question here is, will those ministers in Guinea-Bissau have an impact on restoring civilian government?
It strikes me also that the question of AFRICOM, the outpost that the U.S. is building on the continent, very controversial, but this is the kind of situation where perhaps that would mobilize. Again, you know, talking about Guinea-Bissau and the coup and the question of whether or not coups roll forward from post-colonial violence. And that was Will Ross from the BBC.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And here are the headlines with Femi Okay.
Thank you very much, Farai. The time just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Senior administration officials say that President Obama sent a secret letter to Russian President Dmitry Medvedev last month. The letter suggests that there would be an agreement in which the U.S. would back off from deploying a new missile defense system in Eastern Europe if Russia would help prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. President Medvedev said today that he's not ready to cooperate with Washington, but the letter didn't offer any such trade-off. The Justice Department released secret legal papers yesterday, written during the Bush administration. They included assertions that the president could use the military to combat suspected terrorists within the U.S. without obtaining search warrants. Another memo says that the president could move prisoners to other countries where they might have faced torture. 9 documents were released in all. In international news, Iran is demanding an unreserved apology from Hollywood. A visiting goodwill delegation from Hollywood is in Tehran this week, and the group includes actress Annette Bening. Iran's cultural advisor took the opportunity to reprimand American filmmakers for years of insults and slanders, offending movies, including the epic movie 300 about Spartan warriors.
A thousand nations of the Persian Empire descend upon you.
You threaten my people with slavery and death.
This is madness!
Madness.
This is Sparta!
Ooh, it's giving me chills there. Annette Bening says that she hopes that the Hollywood delegation will help build a bridge between Iran and the US. That was a clip from the movie 300. Of course, it mentions Persians, and the Persians are actually killed in the movie, so that's why Iran isn't too happy. They
same,
have a list
same
of
Same director's
movies.
Doing Watchmen.
Oh!
That's right.
Nice link, Slinky.
There you go.
Very nice.
Thanks, Ben.
You're welcome.
Well, thanks, Femi, and I am Farai Chidea in for Adora Udoji. We've got a question: under what conditions should a judge step aside? How about when someone donates big money to a judge's election campaign, then that same donor appears in that judge's court? What should the judge do? That's the issue at the heart of a case that goes today before the Supreme Court. The wider issue is how we select our judges. We're joined by the New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak, who is in Washington. Let's begin with this case. Tell us a little bit more about the specifics.
So this is a really interesting case, Farai. There was a chief executive of a West Virginia coal mining company called Massey Energy who spent $3 million to support the election of the current Chief Justice of the West Virginia Supreme Court, Brent Benjamin. After Benjamin wins, he casts the 3-2 deciding vote in a case that throws out a $50 million jury verdict against the coal executive's company. And so the question in the case is whether that level of support from someone with an interest in a case should compel the disqualification, the recusal of a judge. And the Supreme Court has never before considered the question. It has always said that if a judge has a direct financial stake in a case, if you own stock in a company, say, then recusal is required by the Constitution's due process requirements. But this question of contributions to the campaigns of or independent support for, as was mostly the case here, an elected judge, what should follow from that is really interesting.
Well, what's the standard? What's the legal standard that the justices are going to be looking at?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's what they're going to try to figure out. The standard that the people objecting to this judge's failure to disqualify himself are proposing is more than appearance of impropriety. They seem to think that you need to show a probability of bias, that it's so likely that this justice would have felt a so-called debt of gratitude that it crosses a line. But exactly what the standard is, exactly where you want to draw the line, is sort of hard. And even though when I sketch out the facts, the things that, you know, stick in your mind is $3 million, my God, it's also the case that this coal executive was not himself a party to the case, his company was. And it's also true he didn't directly contribute very much at all, only $1,000 to the judge's campaign. Most of it was independent campaign expenditures, and most of it was directed really to defeating the justice's opponent. So you get various kinds of levels, and it gets a little bit away from the core question of a direct contribution to a judge's campaign, and that makes it harder for the Supreme Court to know just exactly where to draw the line. And by way of background, I should say, judicial elections, very common. 39 states elect judges. Many, many of them have major campaigns, million-dollar campaigns for these seats. They get money from people who appear before them. Lawyers and litigants contribute to judges all the time, and the judges almost never disqualify themselves from cases in which people who have helped them get elected appear before them. That may be curious, but the general thinking is that a $50 or $1,000 contribution is not enough to cause a judge to have to recuse himself, but maybe $3 million of support is.
Do we have any sense of, you know, amicus briefs often filed with the Supreme Court, who's for and who's against different sides of this case?
I guess it's a little lopsided in this case. Many of the briefs were in favor of requiring disqualification here, including from big corporations, including from the Conference of Chief Justices. The Conference of Chief Justices leaned that way. Many good government groups supported the side thinking disqualification was necessary. But there were some important briefs on the other side as well. There were briefs from people saying this is sort of a free speech issue, that this coal executive should be able to say what he likes on the airwaves. A number of states, led by Alabama, said this is a states' rights issue. The United States Supreme Court should not use the federal constitution to tell states how to run their election systems. There were people who also contended that this whole thing, this focus on disqualification, is really a sort of Trojan horse, and really what it is an attack on elected judges, which many voters in many states think is a great idea, although the U.S. is really an outlier in this. Almost nowhere else in the world are judges elected. Wow. They're mostly appointed, as in the U.S. federal system.
Adam, isn't there an inherent conflict in the law in that in a lot of communities where there are judicial elections, the candidates are required to run at large, not associated with a party? So there's an expectation of even-handedness and objectivity that this kind of behavior would seem to contradict rather, outrageously.
Well, exactly right. What you think you want from a judge, I think, is a kind of independence of mind and action, a sort of scholarly temperament, and the things you associate with political campaigns and what political campaigns bring with them, particularly in terms of money and sometimes quite intemperate ads, is hard to reconcile with that conception of a judge that I just sketched out.
You mentioned that there's so many states, the majority of states actually have elected judges for some positions. Do we have any idea of how the court is going to rule and what justices might go what way?
That's, you know, it's hard to say because it's going to tug them in different directions. The justices, of course, care very much about the integrity of the judicial system. And Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, after her retirement, made this her key cause, judicial independence. And she has just about said that, in her view, this sort of contribution crosses a line. At the same time, the judges are not, the justices are not eager to find new constitutional rights, new constitutional requirements, and they're also not that eager to wade into state systems that the states do have substantial control over. So it's a little hard to say.
Would the decision rule on basically recusal thresholds for all cases of judges? I mean, would the standard that's set here have the tendency to apply very broadly to almost all cases where there's some sort of appearance of conflict?
They can rule broadly. They can rule narrowly. All the plaintiffs in this case are looking for, they say, is, listen, you can leave for another day exactly how low you want to draw the bar, but this goes over the line. So why don't we establish, they say, in this case, that it is possible for so much money to come into a race that recusal is required by the Constitution. And then you can leave for a later day, they say, whether, you know, 2 million or 1 million or 100,000 or 10,000 is the number. All they want to do is establish the proposition that there is a number which is too big.
Much appreciated, and thanks, Adam. My guest was New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak in Washington.
We are always on here at The Takeaway. I'm here with Farai Chidea, who will be hosting with me all week. Farai, thanks so much. That was
a great
couple of hours. Watchmen opens this weekend. Get your smiley badges ready. Slap on your nostalgia perfume. The movie version of the great comic book about flawed superheroes comes out. I'm excited. The reviews are bad, but hey, I loved the graphic novel.
Absolutely.
Who are your flawed superheroes? Are we the only ones obsessed with Watchmen? We could be. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Your takeaway, though?
The good guys in this movie is the military, and they feel they have no other option, but we've seen a drastic spike of human rights violations by the Mexican government, which we are now viewing as Pinochet on crack cocaine.
It's Carlos Spectator, El Paso-based immigration attorney, talking about the fallout from Mexico's drug war, not the movie Watchmen. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go. You are
Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.